Our next case for argument this morning is Flesser against the Department of Labor. We need to have a brief pause. We have been told that there's snow on the East Coast, which has affected the presence of lawyers here, so we need to set up a link to the East Coast. We've got it? All right. Ms. Moskowitz, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for allowing me to participate by phone.
Okay. We are ready to go. Mr. West.
May it please the Court. My name is Joseph West, appearing on behalf of Petitioner Janice Flesser. Your Honors, in this Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower appeal, this Honorable Court should reverse and remand this case so that Ms. Flesser may have the opportunity to conduct discovery to support a theory of coverage of the American Medical Association under Sarbanes-Oxley's whistleblower provisions. Ms. Flesser was a pro se party throughout the administrative process below, and when she was confronted with orders to show cause by the administrative law judges, she did what she could as a pro se party to amass a record to support a theory of coverage, and she also simultaneously asked for an investigation. The administrative law judges, instead of either conducting an investigation or advising Ms. Flesser that she herself had to do so, simply dismissed her claims. Ms. Flesser appealed that those rulings to the Administrative Review Board, which consolidated those cases and ultimately also ruled against her. In not identifying the fact that Ms. Flesser did not receive assistance by the administrative law judges and also ruling against her, the Administrative Review Board committed reversible error. This Court should reverse and remand the case so that Ms. Flesser can have a full and fair opportunity to conduct discovery to support a theory of coverage. It's undisputed in this case that the administrative law judges could have allowed discovery into the question of coverage under Sarbanes-Oxley's whistleblower provisions. The Secretary doesn't contest the authority Ms. Flesser presents on this point, and so there could have been discovery, whether it's bifurcated or not, into this question. It's undisputed also that there was, in fact, no discovery. And the question is why, and the answer is simple. It's that the administrative law judges never told Ms. Flesser, a pro se party, that she herself could do that. They never told her that she could propound interrogatories.
Is there some rule that requires administrative law judges to do that?
We would contend absolutely, Your Honor, and that's the Administrative Review Board's decision in Young versus Schlumberger Oilfield. In that case, the Administrative Review Board reaffirmed the principle that administrative law judges have an obligation, a duty, to assist pro se litigants. And they also have a concomitant duty to not become an advocate in the proceedings. And so the challenge for administrative law judge is to strike a balance between those two competing interests.
I take it your answer is no. There is no rule.
The rule is in Young, Your Honor.
When you have an administrative law case and one says rule, that has a technical meaning under the Administrative Procedure Act, right? It is something issued with notice and comment rulemaking. Now, that was my question, and I take it the answer is no.
I understand, Your Honor. And there is no rule in that sense. But there is rulings by the Administrative Review Board that are binding on the administrative law judges. And the Administrative Review Board has reversed on this issue before and sent cases back to administrative law judges for just this sort of issue, to instructing the administrative law judges to properly assist the pro se party. In Young, the Administrative Review Board found that the administrative law judge properly struck the balance between assisting the pro se litigant on the one hand and not becoming an advocate. And that balance was properly struck there, even though the administrative law judge spent 2 of 3 days of a hearing eliciting testimony from the pro se litigant and repeatedly advising the litigant of the elements of her claim. In this case, all we would have had the administrative law judges do is when Ms. Flesser asks for an investigation into the question of coverage and even asks for counsel, say, wait, Ms. Flesser, you yourself have to conduct the investigation. And by the way, here's the applicable rules that tell you what tools you have at your disposal. You could ask interrogatories. You could ask for documents. You could subpoena documents. You could conduct depositions. Instead of pointing to any of these tools, The administrative law judge just said nothing.
Do you think district judges have an obligation to provide similar help to pro se litigants to, in essence, conduct educational sessions about the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure?
Your Honor, I do not believe that the law is the same in the district courts because the appellate courts have not imposed such a rigorous standard on the district judges.
And in Young, the review board, if I understand it correctly, was affirming the way an administrative law judge had handled.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Any instance in which the review board reversed finding either an abuse of discretion for failing to provide that kind of help or applying a more rigorous standard of review?
Your Honor, in Dale versus Step 1 Stairworks, the administrative review board remanded the case to the administrative law judge, and when it did so, it said that the respondent there, it was the respondent that was pro se, had the burden to show mitigation of damages. And the administrative review board said to the administrative law judge through its decision, you need to properly advise this pro se respondent that he will have the duty to show mitigation, he'll have the burden to show mitigation, so that he may at least have the opportunity to present evidence on that subject. So Dale would be an example of a decision where the administrative review board did send the case back on this issue.
Is there anything in the evidence that indicates that Ms. Fleazar was treated any differently than any other pro se that has gone through this process, this administrative process, or by this particular ALJ?
The evidence in this case stands in sharp contrast to Young, for example, where the litigant, when the appeal came to the administrative review board, all the litigant said to the administrative review board was that I was belittled by the administrative law judge and he didn't help me in the process. And the administrative review board, this is at page 9 to 10 of the slip opinion, said, we're going to construe that generously in the litigant's favor, that it's a claim that the litigant was not sufficiently helped by the administrative law judge. And then ultimately concluded that assistance was sufficient. However, in that case, you'll see that judge went very far to help the litigant get evidence in the record and advise her of her burdens. In contrast to this case, where as soon as Ms. Fleazar got to the administrative law judge level, she was confronted with orders to show cause, did not have the opportunity to conduct any discovery, did what she could to develop a record, and then the judges threw her out of court. And so, absolutely, this case stands in sharp contrast to a case like Young, where assistance was given.
Well, let me ask then, is it your client's position, or is she now abandoning any argument with regard to whether or not the AMA is a not-for-profit corporation and instead turning to argue that she didn't receive due process in challenging
Your Honor,
not-for-profit
the
status?
The question of coverage is a live question. It's undisputed that the American Medical Association is, in fact, a nonprofit corporation incorporated under the laws of Illinois. But that's not dispositive, because as we point out in our brief, there are several theories for coverage of companies that are not themselves public companies and themselves have not issued reports under the applicable laws. Even if you're a private company, you can still be covered under Sarbanes-Oxley's whistleblower provisions. And so the argument would be not that the AMA itself was a public company and covered by virtue of that. It's that it perhaps is covered under any of these other theories. And in order to prove those theories, Ms. Fleazar needs discovery on those points.
What are the other theories?
Your Honor, in our brief, we point out three other possible theories. The first is in the statute itself, Section 1514A, specifically says that a company can be covered and agents of a covered company are also covered. So in the language of the statute itself, agents can be covered even if they themselves are not public. And then the Moorfield case is a principle that essentially says the public company is not a free-floating apex. In fact, it's supported by all of the subsidiary companies under it. That principle that you look to the entire corporate structure in order to determine whether there's coverage or not could apply, or an extension of that principle could apply here if Ms. Fleazar had the opportunity to conduct discovery on that point. And then the third principle would be veil piercing. That's also a possibility. I see that my time is nearing the end. I'd reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Mr. West. Ms. Moskowitz.
Thank you. This is Laura Moskowitz, appearing on behalf of the Secretary of Labor. As your honors have pointed out, there is absolutely no authority establishing the contention that failing to instruct a pro se litigant about discovery during the ALJ proceedings is actually reversible error or an abuse of discretion. We believe Ms. Lezar's counsel has mischaracterized the cases cited, Young versus Schlumberger and Dale versus Step One Stairworks. Neither of those cases have held that the ALJs erred or were required to instruct a pro se litigant as to how to conduct discovery. In fact, in Dale versus Step One Stairworks, as described, the ARB held that the ALJ had applied the incorrect standard in terms of which party bore the burden of proof in showing that the employee had failed to mitigate his damages. And in the remand order, the ARB instructed that the ALJ inform the employer, who was proceeding pro se, that it was, in fact, the employer's burden to show whether or not the employee had failed to mitigate damages. But the ARB did not instruct the ALJ to tell that employer how to conduct discovery or how to obtain evidence as to whether that employee had made efforts to mitigate his damages. There's simply no case that Ms. Lezar's counsel has cited, nor that we know of, that would require the ALJs to actually give that kind of education to a pro se litigant about how to conduct discovery. Moreover, the arguments that the ALJs and the ARBs somehow failed to fulfill their duty to assist Ms. Lezar really ignore the importance of the show cause orders and that process which took place, which provided important guidance to both parties about the nature of the SOX whistleblower claim, what's required for an employer to come under coverage of the SOX whistleblower provisions, and the apparent deficiencies in Ms. Lezar's case. The show cause orders are standard procedural protections provided by the agency, and they give both parties an important opportunity to respond before a complaint is dismissed. In the first show cause order, the ALJ even cited to Part 18 of the regulations, which is the rules of practice and procedure for hearings before the ALJs, and anyone reviewing Part 18, including a pro se litigant, could very easily observe all of the methods under which a party can proceed to conduct discovery. For example, in Part 18.13, it discusses discovery methods, which include depositions, written interrogatories, requests for admissions, etc. In addition, the show cause order cited to Part 1980 of the regulations, which Ms. Lezar herself cited to repeatedly, and 1980 also refers back to Part 18 and makes clear that the ALJ proceedings are conducted in accordance with those rules, which again set forth the method under which parties can conduct discovery. We also note that as part of the show cause process, when both parties responded to the show cause orders, the AMA's response included an affidavit from one of its attorneys that addressed a number of the issues that Ms. Lezar raised in terms of various theories of coverage for the AMA, her nonprofit employer, where, as we've heard, it's undisputed that this employer was not required to file reports under Section 15D of the Securities Exchange Act, did not have a class of securities registered under Section 12, and moreover was not a privately held subsidiary of any publicly traded company. Those affidavits explained that although the AMA had filed other types of SEC reports, none of those were pursuant to Section 12 or 15D, as would be required for coverage under SOX. And it also explained the relationship that Ms. Lezar had alleged with potentially a publicly traded agency, Oppenheimer Capital, that had ceased in the 1990s, well before the enactment of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act or the alleged adverse action in this case, which Ms. Lezar contended began in 2003. We also note that the ALJs and the ARB construed all of Ms. Lezar's allegations liberally, as they're required to do as she was a pro se litigant, reading through hundreds of pages of materials to parse out the strongest arguments that she was making. In addition, the ARB granted her three extensions of time to file her brief and accepted her brief 1 month late, refusing to grant the AMA's request that the board dismiss the appeal for failure to prosecute, explaining that this would have been a very severe result for her. So in all those ways, we contend that the ALJs and the ARB did provide ample assistance for her as a pro se litigant, and that it was not an abuse of discretion or any type of reversible error that they didn't either orders discovery sua sponte, or instruct her as to how to conduct discovery. Again, there's no authority that would have required them to do that. In the other cases that Ms. Blazar has relied on for the proposition that the ALJs could have allowed discovery into this threshold coverage issue, we take no issue with the proposition that the ALJs, it's within their discretion to allow that type of discovery. However, it's not an abuse of discretion to not order discovery sua sponte or not instruct the pro se litigant on how to conduct discovery. We also submit that she did not present any sufficient evidence to warrant further discovery on those various possible theories of coverage. Again, if she has conceded on appeal that she did not demonstrate a disputed issue of material fact regarding the AMA's coverage under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and on that basis alone, we believe the ARB should be affirmed. But not only did she not raise a disputed issue of material fact, she didn't present sufficient evidence to justify further discovery on the issue of whether this nonprofit employer could be covered. Again, not required to file reports under Section 12 or Section 15D, not a private subsidiary of a publicly traded company. And that just really distinguishes this case from the other cases such as Andrews, Mullen, and Gale, where the ALJs did order discovery on coverage issues, because in those cases, those employees were actually working for privately held subsidiaries of publicly traded companies.
And Ms. Moskowitz?
Yes.
This is Judge Hamilton. Are there any circumstances in which you think ALJs in such cases would have an obligation to conduct an investigation upon the request of a pro se party?
No, Your Honor. The ALJs are not, it's not part of their role to actually conduct an independent investigation. The investigatory phase is the first phase of this process, which is conducted by OSHA. And after OSHA conducts an investigation and reaches a conclusion, that decision by OSHA is not reviewable in the sense you can't order more investigation. The ALJ proceeding is an adjudicative process. It's litigation. So each party must actually make out their own case. The ALJs don't independently conduct investigations.
The reason I ask is that the plaintiff's brief, the opening brief, talked only about a duty to order an investigation, and this discovery question and the lessons about discovery didn't come up until their reply brief.
Yes, I believe that's correct, and our interpretation was that they have actually conceded the point that the ALJs and the ARB were not required to conduct this, any kind of investigation in this case. And I believe that the refinement, perhaps, of the argument on appeal is that there was some failure to assist her as a pro se litigant, which we submit they actually did provide more than ample assistance to her as a pro se litigant. So it appears to us that they've actually conceded and agree that there was no independent duty for the ALJs or the ARB to conduct investigation here.
And do you think it's the job of this court to tell the ARB to make sure its decisions are consistent from one to the other?
I believe the ARB's decisions are consistent on this matter of the type of assistance allowed to pro se litigants. And in Young versus Schlumberg Oil Fields, which we cited in our brief, it really sets forth the parameters, which are, again, reiterated in Dale, where the ALJs are required to provide some assistance, but they shouldn't go so far as to appear impartial to one party. And I believe the ARB's decisions have been consistent on that, and that's really within the agency's discretion.
Thank you.
So again, we submit that the ARB and the ALJs did amply fulfill their duty to provide Ms. Blazar with assistance she was due as a pro se litigant, and that it was not an abuse of discretion or error to not instruct her how to conduct discovery, nor did she present sufficient evidence that would warrant further discovery. We would refer to the court to our brief for any further discussion of these issues regarding independent duty to investigate or whether there was a genuine dispute of material fact, but as I mentioned, she has conceded those issues in her appeal brief.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Moskowitz. Anything further, Mr. West? It's going to be very briefly. I think you have about 24 seconds.
Okay, quickly. Young and Dale admittedly are not about discovery, but the principle applies equally across the process, that there must be a duty to assist, and there was no assistance here. The fact that the administrative law judges cited a part of the CFR that may have told Ms. Flezar what she could do is different than telling her, you have to conduct the investigation. And finally, Your Honors, just simply, we're not asking for the world in this appeal. We're only asking that Ms. Flezar be given the opportunity to conduct discovery now that she knows she can do that in order to put forth evidence and a theory of coverage. There's nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.